Hey, welcome to the Parallax Podcast. I'm Liz Brown. A few months back, just prior to the onset of COVID-19 in Philadelphia, we caught up with Alan Greenberger, a distinguished fellow at the Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation and chair of architecture and interior design at Drexel's Westfall College. Alan's career has taken an interesting course. He began practicing architecture at a private firm before co-founding the Design Advocacy Group, an organization of community-driven volunteers with shared interest in design, development, and planning in Philadelphia. His civic work eventually led him to become the executive director of the city's planning commission, then deputy mayor for economic development and director of commerce under Mayor Michael Nutter. In our conversation, Alan and I talked more about his journey, his lifelong passion for cities, how Philadelphia can build towards a more equitable future, and his work to help Drexel University fulfill its commitment to become one of the most civically engaged universities in the country. What I find really interesting about you is that your career spans a lot of different sectors, from private to public service and academic research. And you've done a lot of things that I would consider leadership as well. Can you tell me how all this has played out for you? I know that that's a really general question, but would you describe that?
Well, it's a combination of will from me about things I wanted to do, along with some dumb luck and being in the right place at the right time. When I look back on how did this happen, because I thought from a teenager I wanted to be an architect, and I went to school for architecture. I got a job in architecture. I advanced in my firm and eventually into leadership in my firm for a long time, 34 years practicing architecture and really liking it. But I got my firm involved in more planning work through commissions, but I also got more civically involved. And that really goes back to my time in college. I think the very first thing that I did, aside from, you know, schoolwork in college, was to get involved with a local community design center in a poor neighborhood in Troy, and got involved in building a little park in front of their building, and then gotten more involved and actually wound up working with them, designing some affordable housing in Albany for a kind of a sister organization across the river. So it was always there. And even as a kid, what fascinated me that I thought was architecture, what really fascinated me was how cities worked and how people lived in them together. I have this story that I've written a little essay about when I was probably six, seven years old, snowing, grew up in Brooklyn. I was standing in the back of our house. The houses were separated by these little alleys that were not much wider than this room, this little booth we're sitting in. And I was standing in the back, and a snowball came out of nowhere and landed at my feet. And I looked up, and it was thrown by a couple of teenagers who were on the roof of a six-story building around the corner. And I thought, wow. I mean, I probably didn't think anything as a seven-year-old. But looking back on it, I thought to myself, that's amazing that in this environment, around the corner, like a whole other universe in some ways, these two guys could connect with me, trying to probably take me out, you know, with a snowball. And it was just sort of an amazing sense of connection about what cities are about. So I was always interested in that. And I got us involved in these planning exercises in around the year 2000. I founded the Design Advocacy Group, which grew from two of us to six of us to 15 of us to 30 of us to 60 of us to, I think now, a kind of online membership of well over 1,000. And the thing that drove it actually was email, because what we realized is that we could run this operation without any money. All we had to do was email information around. It was all about information and meeting every now and then. And we conned First Temple University and then the AIA Center for Architecture into giving us space to have our monthly meeting. So I got us involved in all these things and about city building. And at some point, who was the head of the William Penn Foundation, loves telling this story that I have no recollection of, but she insists that it happened. Meeting at the William Penn Foundation with a number of people who were involved in some of the initiatives that they had funded about trying to return Philadelphia to a more organized way to do planning and design. And I was there, and she says that I said that if this is going to happen for the way we want, somebody at this table is going to have to step up and get involved in a more meaningful way. And then the very next year, I got asked by Wendell Pritchett, who is now the provost at Penn, and Wendell's an old friend from West Philly. He's working on the Nutter campaign, and he asked me to, that summer of 07, he asked me to lead a task force that would deal with zoning and planning reform. And we produced a white paper, a group of us, and then mayor gets elected in 07, becomes mayor in January of 08, and he asks me to join the City Planning Commission and as a citizen. And the first thing they asked me to do was to help them find a new executive director for the Planning Commission. We had a list of people across the country, really great people, super accomplished. Started calling them. Everybody was incredibly flattered to be asked. Most of them had already solid jobs. They weren't interested, but several of them were interested. And we, over the next several months, we conducted a bunch of interviews. And for one reason or another, mostly personal related stories, they couldn't do it. So here we are 6 months later, and we don't have an executive director of the Planning Commission. The deputy mayor at the time, Andy Altman, who had become a friend at that point, says we ought to have the mayor do a speech on planning and kind of gin this up a bit, have him come to a Planning Commission meeting. And we thought, well, okay, this would be a great idea. Maybe we should have it not in our normal place because there may be a few more people interested. So we got the Academy of Natural Sciences to loan us their auditorium, 300-400 people. And we said, okay, the mayor's going to give a speech on planning in then somewhere like 2 weeks out for a normal Planning Commission meeting. 700 people showed up.
That's amazing.
And we had to, we filled that auditorium, and then we filled another room with a video feed. The mayor gave a great speech. I mean, a number of us who were involved in writing and editing this speech gave a great speech. And at the end of it, I thought, well, this is great. Everybody's like super excited now, and we don't have an executive director. And I called the deputy mayor, called Andy that night, and I said, I think I know what the answer is. And before I could even tell him what I thought the answer was, he knew the answer. And he said, oh, this is great. You're going to do it, right? This is fantastic. We go to the mayor. Let's do this. Yeah, that is my idea. But, like, calm down. Let's go to the mayor and see what he thinks. And I went to the mayor. We had what amounted to a job interview, I guess. And at the end of it, he said, I want you to do this. Like, then this like sunk into my heart that, oh my God, I'm talking about leaving my firm. I've been there for 34 years. I've been a partner for 22 years. I've hired half the people in this firm. This is a big move. I was about to go on vacation. I said, let me take my vacation. Just, I'm going to do it. But let me take my vacation and think about how to do this, how to tell my partners that I was leaving. It's a terrible time. It was the worst vacation I'd ever have. I was anxious and heartsick over this idea that I was going to leave my practice. I came back, we had a partner meeting, and I told them what I wanted to do, and they were unbelievably gracious and excited for me, which gave me a tremendous amount of relief. Took a lot of anxiety away, and there it was. I wouldn't say it was accidental. I mean, you could track the steps that lead up to it. I thought I'd put myself in the path, for sure. But who knew that Michael Nutter was going to become mayor? He was running fifth out of five when the primary started, and he surged into number one and became mayor. So I jumped and became the head of planning. And gee, I don't think it was more than a month or two or three into the office holding when Andy Altman, the deputy mayor's chief of staff, came running up and said, we have to go over to City Hall. Mayor's making an announcement that we all have to be at. Okay. And the announcement was that Andy was going to leave the administration and go run the London Olympics Legacy Project. It's a very big deal for him. And there it was. He was leaving in then June of 09. And before he left, we met. And I said, well, what are we doing? How's this all going to work? Who's going to take your place? And he said, I'm going to tell the mayor you're going to take my place. I'm going to ask him to appoint you. And he did as interim deputy mayor, which then became not interim, but full deputy mayor about a year later. And I served as deputy mayor for planning and economic development. And what the mayor had said to me was, look, now by 09, the city was fully engaged in the deep recession. Unemployment was soaring. And he said, I need you to not run the planning office anymore day to day. I need you to run commerce. I need you to focus on economic development. And I said, oh, but I came to this administration as an architect and a planner to work on this. He said, don't worry. It's in your portfolio. You can do whatever you want. I'm just telling you, don't run it day to day. So he had crashed.
How did that feel for you to move away from that?
Well, it took me about 2 hours because he told me he wanted me to do this. He came barging into a dinner I was having with a friend from Boston.
Oh, wow.
Not barging in. I mean, that sounds bad. He came in and he said, can I talk to you for a few minutes? Yeah. And he said, this is what I want you to do. I said, okay, let me finish dinner and I'll call you back later tonight. I called him back when I got home around 10:30 and I said, all right, I'm doing this. I said, but what I want is I want you to support me in being the chair of the planning commission, which is the commission of citizens and appointees. He said, fine, you know, that's, I don't have a problem with that. And it allowed me to keep a strong hand in planning without running it day to day, but now is running the commerce department.
How do you feel your experience with planning helped with the commerce department?
That's a really good question, because I think had anybody known how little I knew about, financing of projects and all that, they might have been shocked. But I learned quickly. And what I was able to do, because I had these dual responsibilities, is I was able to more positively connect planning ideas and initiatives with getting things done. It was a more natural act for me. So an example was we got invited to be one of the four inaugural cities in something called the Rose Fellowship. It was sponsored through Urban Land Institute, through the Rose Foundation. And basically, the deal was these four cities were going to be given the opportunity over a year to come to ULI with an idea for a project that they would be interested in, that we, each city, would be interested in. And they would bring some expertise to us and give us an opportunity to sort of get out of town and think about how to implement these projects. And the one that I was most interested in as kind of the team leader of this thing, it involved Mike DeBaradinas at the time, who was head of Parks and Rec, Beverly Coleman, who was at that point, I think, at Temple University, and the mayor himself, the four of us with a team. We came with this idea that we wanted to really move the needle on getting North Broad Street redeveloped. I'd had some involvement with the idea through private practice with Center City District. Before I left practice, I was part of one of the principals in the Temple University's new master plan. So it was in my mind anyway. And we said, this is what we want to do. And we started talking about how to do it. We started identifying who the critical stakeholders were and meeting with them. And of course, one of the things that grew out of that was a very strong sense, mostly from me, but everybody agreed, was that we need to once and for all get the Divine Lorraine Hotel renovated. That if it
was a big project.
If it wasn't renovated, there would just be this problem right in the middle that, you know, 13-story abandoned building does not give anybody a lot of incentive to do anything around it. So we said, we got to get this done. My chief of staff, Brian Flanagan, and then subsequently one of my senior team members, Jeremy Thomas, spent a lot of time doing quiet, nobody ever saw it kind of work to turn what was a bad commercial debt sitting in a bank in New York into convincing that bank to put the debt up for sale, so that we could find a new developer for this project. And then once we found the developer, we had to work really hard and eventually help finance the doing of that project. It took us 4 solid years of work that nobody ever saw to get that project to be a project.
There are a lot of new projects all over the city, actually, and a lot of mixed use. What are your thoughts on the mixed use development here in Philadelphia and like where it's going to?
Well, you know, on a project-by-project basis, some of it's better than others. Some of it's better design. Some of it's a little better planning. But I think the broad picture is that people have accepted the idea much more powerfully than they used to that mixed use is a very positive thing. Now, mixed use at its most simple level is, you know, people living above and there's commercial activity below, retail. Okay, well, that's great. I mean, we need livelier streets. But I think there's also a sense that mixed use can have a broader message. Things like what we're doing here on Drexel property with Wexford Scientific over here at UCity Square and at Schuylkill Yards, where mixed use has a more vibrant idea that it is about academic institutions, it is about commercial activity, it is about residential, it is about retail, it's about all those things together. And I think you've seen now a total swing in the culture to believe that that is a very positive thing to do.
And I know that I guess they refer to the whole University City as the innovation district in the city. And I mostly work between 34th and 36th in Market. And I used to work in Center City until I realized all of the resources that are over here. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's so much mixed use development. I can pretty much do everything I need to do within these couple of blocks.
Wait, I don't know, 5 years. And UCity Square is going to be a very vibrant mixed-use development. I think it's going to be very successful. It's going to have a new public school in it. Drexel's School of Nursing and part of our School of Medicine are going to be there, as well as other buildings that are probably going to be occupied through medical research and offices, as well as more residential. A new street has been put through. In fact,
which I found the most interesting.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that was always part of their plan. And actually, through me, we, the city, helped fund that to because that was going to then be a public street. And we funded it through our capital program. Not a lot, but enough to sort of make a difference. And I think all of that, you know, is going to be have a very positive result. We need more jobs in the city, for sure. And these anchor institutions out here, of which in University City, if you want to count it this way, you have five of them. You got Penn Medicine, Children's, University of the Sciences, and Drexel. And then there's a host of other smaller ones. That's a big network of innovation and talent and research, and you can see it happening. A year ago, well, more than a year ago, 2 years ago, my brother, who works for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, told me, he said, you know, watch what's going to happen, because he said there are researchers at Children's who are having tremendous success at curing childhood leukemia. And he noted the one fellow in particular, this fellow Carl June, who I've had the opportunity to meet, lovely fellow, who has been spearheading this. And this is all related to this immunotherapy and biological and genetic research that is finding ways to cure diseases by sort of re-engineering your own genetics and putting them back to fight disease. And Spark Therapeutics, which is now a very big tenant in Schuylkill Yards in the old Bulletin building, which is now One Drexel Plaza. That's what they're involved with in childhood blindness diseases. And they've become a very big operation, again, stemming out of research that was done in this neighborhood. It's extraordinary. There are two buildings being built at the Navy Yard that are in the business of doing the remanufacturing. It's like they're industrial buildings in a way, but it's remanufacturing of genetic material to fight disease, one by a collaboration between a firm named Wuxi, Chinese firm, and another one named Aptex, Wuxi Aptex. Adaptimmune is the other one that's building down there. This is an enormous, enormous set of changes in biotechnology that are all coming out of this neighborhood.
The only people I hear talk about the biotech movement here in Philadelphia are people that have touched it in some way. And I recently I've been going back and forth between Philadelphia and Boston for design conferences. And I find it to be so interesting that I went on a tour there and they had all this talk about biotech and research going on in Boston, but I don't see people doing the same thing here. And I almost feel like we have, at the very least, just as much going on as what they're doing in biotech in Boston. And I don't understand why people don't talk about that. Why do people not know Philadelphia as being a city for biotech innovation?
Well, it's a good question. it's a frustrating question.
Is it just me, or I feel like we're a big deal.
We are a big deal. there are other places. Boston certainly is one of them. San Diego, University of California, San Diego, and San Francisco are two others that have been doing a lot of research and have made biotechnology a centerpiece of their innovation centers and economic growth as well. But we are right in there. I'm not sure if I have a good answer to why it's less known. It's a little bit of a Philadelphia disease.
What is our center then? What is it that people know us for in regards to innovation?
Well, I think increasingly it's that. One of the issues that we have, which is related to your question, is that we don't have a wealth of corporations that are headquartered here that are in consumer-oriented businesses. Now, Comcast is. That's the big one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, huge.
But if you look at the other big corporations here, our corporations tend to be more business-to-business type operations. You look at Aramark. Aramark's not really in the, people know, I've heard of Aramark, but it's not really in the consumer business. They're in the business of doing food services to institutions who then deliver the food to you. You may not even know it comes from an Aramark operation. FMC, which has their name on a big building that Brandywine built over at 29th and Walnut. FMC is a business that got into the chemical business. Its name is its name comes from Farm Machinery Corporation. It started out as an agricultural machinery business in California, I think, that has morphed into a giant agrochemical and general chemical business. They're not selling to consumers. They're selling to other businesses. So you don't know who they are. We don't know who they are, as opposed to the Googles and the, you know, Facebooks of the world that we intersect with all the time. A guy who I got to know when I started working with the tech business, a friend now, Bob Mowell, and Bob was recently in the paper over some new tech business that he has created. His strength has always been in business-to-business operations. They are technology companies that he's created, sold, recreated another one, sold again, and he keeps doing this again and again. He's very talented at it, but it's not something that you and I as consumers will really ever see. So these businesses that are vibrant here, we just don't see them. And therefore, they don't get the attention and the press that they deserve. You know, what's going on down at the Navy Yard with companies like Wuxi AppTec and Adaptimmune, again, they're really business to business. Their business model is to have pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and other medical establishments come to them to do the, in essence, the genetic manufacturing that's needed to do this, you know, these disease cures. We as consumers are the beneficiaries, but their names will hardly ever be attached to what gets delivered to us, because what gets delivered to us is from the hospital, right? Or a drug company that's making a particular medicine. You won't ever hear their names.
That makes me want to talk a little bit more about things like Startup PHL and the emerging entrepreneurship community here in Philadelphia. Can we talk a little bit about what Startup PHL is doing?
Yeah, well, I haven't because I've been out of office.
Well, not now, but what it became.
I certainly, the mayor, me, John Grady from PIDC were involved in the creation of Startup PHL. And the way it happened, actually, you'll like this story. It somewhat came together because I saw a Facebook post by a young woman named Gloria Bell. Gloria put this post up, rather random post, about complaining that the city wasn't paying enough attention to technology and startups. So I reached out to her and I said, you know, would you come meet with me and tell me what you're thinking? Gloria brought up one or two people with her, as I recall, and we said, okay, you want the city involved, what can we do? And she said, well, number one was pay attention. You know, this is for real, pay attention. And so we started to pay attention. We started to do homework. One of my staff, my deputy chief of staff, Andy Racklin, started doing homework on, well, who's out there? And we found that there was an attorney in town who was very active in helping tech startups. We found, you know, this whole infrastructure of people that we didn't know about, and we started meeting with them. We started going to their events. We paid attention, just what Gloria said, pay attention. And suddenly we were in the game in a way. One of the things I came to see in public life was that when an administration even just pays attention, things get better because everybody else says, oh, this is important. I guess we should all also pay attention. But then we started thinking about, well, what else can we do? And a few of us from PIDC and I went up to New York and met with some of our colleagues at the New York Economic Development Corporation. And they had started this fund. I don't know what the name of it was, but they'd started some fund. Honestly, it was the magnitude of their fund was never going to change the amount of money in the game. It was a marker that the city was interested in this. And so we saw what they were doing and said, well, that's a pretty good idea. Let's do that. In fact, let's do the same amount of money that they started with, which was $6 million. We merged some money that was available through PIDC, and we sought a private sector partner. We took proposals, and we eventually landed on First Capital. Oh, God, now I'm blanking on the name. This is terrible. Josh Koppelman's operation.
Oh, First Round Capital.
First Round Capital. I knew First and Capital were in there, but I thought something was missing. First Round Capital.
You were close.
Yeah, who brought some funds to it as well. And we said, we, the city and PIDC, we don't want to be in the business of picking who to fund. You know that world, Josh, and First Round. You figure that out. And they did, and they started making investments. And again, $6 million in the world of venture capital is not that much money.
It goes quick. It
goes real quick. We identified a very specific segment of venture capital work that was relevant to us. And they started making recommendations, and we started making investments. And it was all of which was to say, yes, there's some good projects. We should be behind that. But it was really about, we need to be in the game to say that it's important to the city as a marker to private investors with a lot more money to say you should be here too.
Yeah.
And the presence of venture capital is a big deal. I mean, one of the reasons that places like Boston and New York and a couple of other places thrive is because there's this kind of critical mass of both entrepreneurialism, but also venture capital, media attention that simply feeds itself.
A lot of people that I work with in the startup community, they'll go to San Francisco. They'll go wherever right. they have to go to get people to give them money. But one of my biggest concerns as both a planner and a technologist is inclusion. And how do we actually include more Philadelphians in things like entrepreneurship and the innovation community here? Organizations like Startup PHL are launching scholarship opportunities for diverse companies. But I'm wondering if there's more that we can do.
Well, there is, and we started doing some of that when I was in office, and I know a lot of it's ongoing. One of the things that I would tell my commerce staff with some regularity, probably to the point that they, you know, didn't want to hear about it anymore, was don't think that entrepreneurship only means technology. And the story I would tell, and I made this story up, but I'm sure it's true in lots of places. I said there's a lot of creativity in lots of communities that you haven't heard about. And it could be something, well, in my own neighborhood, in Mount Airy, there's a young man who I got to know, Jimmy Reed, who he's a great baker. And he's ambitious, and he wants to do more. And what did he do? He created a business around his ability to really be a good baker. That's a startup. That's entrepreneurial. Jimmy's making a life for himself, and he expanded into various other businesses, and he's had to figure it out over time. You know, like, okay, maybe I've extended it too far. Maybe this is the one I shouldn't be doing and this I should be concentrating here, but he's doing it, you know? And there's a ton of people like that, particularly in the poor neighborhoods. And the example I used to make, the one I invented, was there's some young woman in, you know, in pick a neighborhood, North Philadelphia, that is a spectacular, great, who knows how to braid hair in ways that are unbelievably creative and interesting, but she has no capital and she has no knowledge of how to make or how to turn her creativity into a business. We need to help her with that. You know, that stuff, even at its most successful, that those kinds of things are not going to be terribly visible in a big way. They will be very visible, however, in a smaller way, in a more local way. And I think we should be completely happy about that and celebrate it. And this ties into neighborhood commercial districts. We have all these corridors. There's dozens and dozens of them in Philadelphia that used to be the corridor on which our parents, grandparents would shop. So you'd go, you know, you'd walk there, you get food, you'd go to the butcher, the baker, and you know, you'd get stuff. Well, obviously, retailing has changed dramatically. Not necessarily for the better, but I think, but you know.
Everyone's shopping online now, too.
Well, yeah, and then online is a whole other layer on top of this. But prior to the online, it was the Walmarts and the Targets and these big operations that are aggregating more and more things to sell, right? Walmart didn't used to sell food. Now they're in the food business, too, as is Target. And everybody's becoming, just even in the brick and mortar land, they're all becoming the same thing. The supermarket wants to have a pharmacy and wants to sell you dry goods, more and more of them. The pharmacy wants to have a couple of aisles of food, right, in addition to the to their stuff. And the Walmarts and Targets of the world want to have it all, right?
So, of course.
And then there's online.
And then there's Amazon.
And then there's Amazon.
It's a whole other monster.
And then there's online. And so these commercial corridors have changed dramatically. We as a city, through city council appropriations, have put a lot of money into redoing these corridors and making them look nicer. What's the point? All right? And I think the point is twofold. One is that people do measure somewhat the health of their neighborhoods by how vibrant and safe and pleasant the commercial corridor is, whether or not they absolutely rely on it for things. My old neighborhood in West Philadelphia at 46th Street, corridor along Baltimore Avenue for the whole time we were there, which was 16 years, was kind of a sleeper. There were a few things, but, you know, not a lot of stuff going on. Now it's quite vibrant and it's all filled up. And the same thing with my neighborhood up in Mount Airy. That corridor has become much more vibrant, but not with generally, not with the day-to-day things that you need, but with other things, food, services. Up in Mount Airy, there's a wonderful little shop that's a kind of do-it-yourself clothing-making place where you can buy fabric. She has sewing machines. She'll help you understand how to use them if you want to make your clothes. It's a much more interesting smattering of combination of services, both process things, insurance company, real estate company, with community culture, theater, food operations. And those things, I think, make a difference to a neighborhood. But the really critical thing about them, the real reason to be interested in them, is they are the access point for entrepreneurial activity that's coming out of the neighborhoods because they are generally more affordable, right? You want to have a business? I know that right near the zone right between Mount Airy and Germantown. I'm going to get her business name wrong. She's a baker. She makes cakes. I think she does a lot of work for weddings and so on. She found probably a fairly affordable place to operate her business, as did Jimmy Reed, which was his business was called Little Jimmy's. That's where it starts. That's where you can make something happen. Does anybody know that there are 20 new businesses, you know, lining that corridor from small-time neighborhood folks who have figured out how to capitalize their creativity? No. I mean, we know it because we live there. But does anybody else know it? Not really. It doesn't matter.
It's already transformed right. for the people right. who live there.
Right. And so that young woman who can do hair braiding, that's the place, if she's not working it out of her house, you know, that's the place, or maybe she is working it out of her house and now she needs an operation because she needs an employee. That's a big step up. And so the question then becomes, how do you capitalize that? The other day at Drexel, we had a guest lecturer, Charles Lomax, who's doing some pretty interesting real estate development work, including just a couple of blocks from here in Mantua. And Charles comes from a very prominent family in Philadelphia. His father was a doctor. His father grew his medical practice from this pretty small operation into multiple medical centers that had even a national reach through some of the contracting that they did. And, you know, there's this long tradition in the Lomax family of service and serving in underserved communities that now Charles is trying to play out as a real estate developer. But he quoted something from his father, which I really liked, and it stuck with me. And his father said, well, in reference to the African-American community, he said, well, we're living in a world of capitalism without capital. Where does capital come from for all these creative people who want to start something? Well, one of the places it comes from, this goes to the whole history of the United States and the sort of underlying racism that has infected a tremendous amount of our culture. Redlining denied a lot of people the opportunity to create wealth by owning land and housing. I mean, it's as simple as that. The opportunity to buy property and to own something. I mean, I don't call it real estate for nothing. It's real, and it is estate-worthy. It is passable from one generation to another. That's probably the most typical way that Americans build wealth. You have equity in your home, and you can borrow against it. That's one way to raise capital. The other way is through maxing out your credit cards, which is something that entrepreneurs do all the time. It's probably not the best way to go raise money because of the interest rates, but people do it all the time. And then they go to their friends and family, you know, and they say, help me out. You know, are you willing to invest in my business idea? All of those are how capital gets accumulated. What we did in the city, we said, well, those are great, but there's inherent problems in a lot of it.
It doesn't work for low-income people, for one. If you don't have a relative to ask for help, you're kind of screwed.
Exactly. So one of the things that we did was we became part of this thing called Kiva, K-I-V-A, Zip.
I love Kiva.
Kiva Zip. Another deputy chief of staff, Sylvie Gayer Howard, who's now deputy commerce director. Sylvie really worked hard to get Kiva set up here in Philadelphia. And it's had success. I mean, this is the craziest thing that people see these entrepreneurial ideas online from anywhere.
Anywhere in the world. I've been on Kiva for years.
And they invest in them.
Yeah. That's,
and, you know, this is all micro-lending, $5,000, $10,000 at a clip, which is all often somebody needs to get it going. Will there be a failure rate? Of course there will be a failure rate. That's the way it goes. But at least there's an opportunity. So that's something we instituted in Philadelphia, and I can point to, at least before I left office, I can point to a whole series of success stories. We, through Michael Nutter's connections to Goldman Sachs, oddly enough, to create this 10,000 small business program where it's still running every year. I think they run two cycles a year, 20-something participants, businesses that have started, and it's like instant MBA. That probably is overstating it a bit, but it's a very practical set of instructions on how to manage, do public relations, and expand and grow and stabilize your business. And so there would be, and it was coming from all quarters of Philadelphia. It was every single one. I went to almost every graduation from this group. It was, and it's being conducted through the community college.
That's amazing.
With a curriculum that was developed up at Babson College in New England. This thing is great. And the people who have engaged in this, they're coming from everywhere. There's, you know, in terms of racial mix, gender mix, it's a really impressive group of people. And they love it. They get this great training and confidence in building their business. And then they go and keep building their business. And the businesses are all over the map. You know, from food operations to business services, all kinds of crazy stuff going on.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of that in Philadelphia, though. There are a lot of programs like that and a lot of people coming in from outside of the city to take advantage of these programs while people in the city don't even know that some of them exist.
Right.
I think that's really unfortunate, but because giving people from different backgrounds the opportunity to fail is one of the most important things to me personally.
Absolutely.
If you don't even have the opportunity to fail, then that's kind of it. A lot of people aren't going to even go beyond the idea stage.
And all of these things are great. They are putting a dent in a much bigger problem, about particularly about capitalization and about expertise. In public school, in high school, is anybody getting an education related to how to start a business? Generally, the answer is no. Getting an education on how to amass capital to start a business? And generally, the answer is no. Organizations like PIDC under John Grady, who just left the post and is now taken over by Ann Nevins, they have really, and again, people don't know this, they have really reoriented their entire business operation towards smaller lending to help businesses throughout the city capitalize and expand and grow. It's not micro-lending. There are other organizations that do that better. But, you know, PIDC is making stacks of $50,000 loans to businesses throughout the city to help them grow. And a lot of them are minority-owned, women-owned businesses. People don't know this. And so there's a public relations job to do. And I think the public relations part, you know, it always sounds trite, but it's so important. And it's about the narrative. And one of the things that Michael Nutter and I, in particular because of connection to businesses, realized is that we need to fix the narrative of this city. And I don't mean fix it towards something that it isn't, but actually fix it towards something that is. So the narrative of the city, going back to the 50s and 60s, was the loss of industrial jobs, significant loss of industrial jobs, significant loss of population, and is kind of this rust belt, blue collar, difficult people, highly opinionated, you know, crazy sports fans, the whole thing was the narrative. And the truth is, I think that the media, who is now wildly under-resourced anyway, and I would say my friends in the media won't like this, but I think in some cases a bit, not so much the local media, but the more national media, somewhat lazy about really understanding what's happening in cities, left us with a narrative that was, one, inaccurate, and two, very destructive of investment and business and job growth in the city. And I'm not saying that some of the narrative wasn't well-earned, but in this city, educational institutions, medical institutions, the old eds and meds thing, we have the highest percentage of our jobs are in those sectors than any other big city in this country. It's something approximately a third of the jobs in this city are related to those two sectors. I think this in second place is Boston, and they're, you know, in the high 20% somewhere. At least, those were the numbers when I left office.
But we have such a high poverty rate.
We do.
More than 26% of Philadelphians below the federal poverty level. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting into these fields and taking over these jobs. There are a lot of opportunities being missed. It makes me a little bit skeptical about some of the work that we do in innovation not touching. It's not touching enough of the community members that are people that are from Philadelphia. And I'm wondering what role can we play and what role can the government play in fixing that?
You know, there's an old bumper sticker, I don't know if it's still around, that says, think globally, act locally. And the problem is, this is the problem you're describing in Philadelphia is a big problem whose causes tie to a whole series of current and historical realities in Philadelphia, the loss of industrial jobs being one of the most critical ones, because that was the access point for people without a college education to get work. Now, there were plenty of other things going on that exacerbated the problem. Just on the radio yesterday, I happened to hear a piece on HYY about Post Brothers, who are doing a development project, and they've always been doing development projects with mixed shop, union, non-union. They've gone through their struggles with it, but it seems to have settled down, and now they're doing projects in neighborhoods like North Philadelphia. I think that was the project they were talking about, where there is a real program to engage the employment of local people who know something about construction, because construction is one of those fields that is that ought to be highly accessible in poor communities for people with craft and skills. And they're there. It's not like they're not there. What's the problem? Well, one of the problems is that the skill trades in the unions have largely been way underrepresented in their terms of their minority members. Way underrepresented. Everybody knows this. The only one that's highly integrated with more minority members is the laborers union, which is the lowest of the skill trades. Important work, but nevertheless, lower skill trade. Post Brothers, I think, is doing a really exceptional job trying to make this work at a more grassroots level. The grassroots level means it's working for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 people at a time, but it's what you got to do.
And they're also, I think the thing that a lot of people don't think about in this type of discussion is entry-level roles. I'm a designer, I'm a developer. Had I not had an introduction to vocational training and things like that, which they do have BOCES in New York State.
Right. I remember BOCES.
Yeah, I always thought BOCES was so cool. I was like, oh, I want to go learn how to build computers or something. But it was, for me, an introduction to things like computer science and networking and all of those other techie things that I've been involved in. I would not have been introduced to those things in any other way. I think that a lot of people think to introduce vocational programs into lower income communities, but don't think about the fact that it can be an entry level thing into something bigger, into going to college. I think that most people are just like, oh, let's give them skilled jobs, but don't think about fixing the schools, helping these lower income families just go higher up in the education system. I went to school for my master's in urban planning with only 3 other Black students in my graduate program out of about 50 students. I think that's extremely unfortunate. And also, barely anyone that I went to school for planning with grew up with a low income background or in a family with socioeconomic issues. So how are they really solving problems? They don't have the same perspective. I want to find more ways to resolve urban poverty with people who have actually experienced it. I think that the way that we do that is by creating more programs that touch communities and introduce them to these different fields.
And introduce young people to role models.
Yes.
That, you know,
Which is tough.
It is tough. There's a group at Drexel now called, they just changed their name, it's now called Black Westfall. It used to be called Drexel Black Architecture Student Society. And, you know, they were talking about this too. And so I asked one of my good friends, Emmanuel Kelly, who's probably like the senior most African-American distinguished architect in this city. I said, and he graduated of Drexel, by the way, and other places, you know, like Harvard, I think. I asked him to come, would you come talk to the students? Just tell them your story. And he, very, very gracious guy, and he came and talked to them. And I, you know, and what was interesting, I think we probably had about, it felt like about 20 of our African-American students in architecture and I think a few in interiors as well. The most interesting part was for them to see each other, because you can live a very isolated life in school, and to see that there was more of them than they thought was great. I asked Charles Lomax, the guy I was referring to the other day, African-American developer, I asked him to come because he's a great role model for you know, what you can do. And it's not like he grew up in wealth, but he, you know, his family has a great story. Director of facilities, Donald Moore, African-American. He went to the Charles Lomax lecture and he said, can I do one of these things? And said, absolutely. And would you be willing to meet with our, you know, black student group? And he said, absolutely that too. So we need to keep putting the role models out. One is to give minority students, and particularly minority students from more impoverished neighborhoods, the ability to see that there is a path. You know, takes hard work, right? All the usual stuff, but there's a path. And there are people out there doing it. It's not like this is nothing. There's a lot more out there than you think. And there are oftentimes jobs that young people don't even know exist.
Yeah, there were a lot of things I didn't know existed. I didn't know what industrial design was until after I had already went to school for urban planning and then did the second master's in information design and tech. And I was like, wow, I should have probably done industrial design. That's actually what I was interested in as a kid.
You know,
I didn't know any of these things. I didn't even know what an urban planner was until I was in grad school.
Right. It's funny. Every year at the Commerce Department, we used to have this high school day where I don't know exactly how we organize this, but we get kids in from local schools simply to introduce them to our staff so that our staff could tell them what they do. And they were always jobs that nobody had ever heard of. You know, what do you do? Well, I'm a contract specialist. I work on, contract conformance. It's not a job I ever heard of when I was 17 years old. You know, in fact, none of the jobs that were in commerce were jobs that anybody had heard of when they were 17 years old. And yet there they are in commerce with a very diverse employment base. And people coming to them saying, well, this is what I do, and I have a good job. It's serious. It's contributing to the city getting better. They pay me fairly, and there's good benefits. Wow. Who knew, right? And I think, you know, we have to get the knowledge of these things out there. Certainly, our anchor institutions and big corporations have to be working really hard to, when they have jobs that are more available to people without, for instance, a college education, that it's known that we reach into communities to do that. I mean, Drexel, we're working very hard to do this. But, you know, again, the wins are not at the scale of anything anybody's going to notice tomorrow. So two projects that we did in this city. One was this hotel at the corner of 15th and Chestnut, 50-story, 40-something story hotel. And the other was the redo of the gallery into the fashion district.
Which is an amazing. I just finally went in there.
It's nice.
Yeah. So different.
I mean, and hopefully we'll be successful. Both of those projects included a public financing scheme called tax increment financing, the short version of which is that the taxes you were going to pay anyway, the increment between what you would pay now with the undeveloped property and what you pay now or what you then will pay with the developed property, that tax increment basically is used to underwrite debt to support the doing of that project. It's kind of weird, slightly counterintuitive, but it really works. Those two projects were the biggest tax increment finance deals in the history of this city. They required approval. They're controversial. And she said, well, why'd you do it? You did it to support some developer. And the answer was no, actually not.
A lot of people jump to that, actually. Well, they don't think about all the other moving pieces.
It's an easy conclusion to jump to. We did them because in the case of the hotel, there's going to be 400 to 500 jobs created in that hotel. And most of those jobs, we know from historical evidence, are going to go to Philadelphians. And the hotel world is one of those businesses where people actually can advance. And Don Peebles, who's hopefully going to renovate the very prominent African-American national developer, going to renovate the old family court. Don came to council and talked about this. And he said, you know, this actually is a business where people advance. And he has a personal story that goes with it. So we thought, well, several hundred jobs in one shot, that's great. It's the same thing with the fashion district. They were projecting that there would be 1,000 new jobs. And we know that most of those will go to Philadelphians and most of those will be entry level. So I say, yeah, but they're, you know, bad jobs or they're, you know, they're all $7.25 an hour jobs. And honestly, it's very hard to gather information on this of exactly what people pay. What I think I was able to learn, that level pay is not as common as people think. Now, it's not spectacular either. But again, this is a way into something.
You had mentioned as well that I know for a fact also that Drexel is doing a lot. And President John Fry committed Drexel to becoming the most civically engaged university in the United States. What work are you doing in your role at the university to accomplish this mission?
I think there's a lot of things. I mean, we're sitting here at the Dornsife Center. that is a big investment in this neighborhood that is running a lot of things that do engage our students, but are really there for the benefit of this community. We are trying as best we can to draw more students into living within sort of campus proper. We can't control the real estate market that we don't own and exists beyond us, but we would really like more students to be on campus and less in the neighborhoods to sort of put a bit of a damper on some of the development, which is not very good development. Some of the development is pretty good. I'm very pleased by what I saw happen on the 3600 block of Lancaster, and I had something to do with it, actually, while I was deputy mayor, involving not having that whole block torn down.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, some of the development's not very good, and you know, you can walk around the neighborhood. You see it. You know it when you see it. The university just bought, with Tower Health, bought the operations of St. Christopher Hospital, and President Fry is already, you know, engaging the group of us who advise him on things like real estate. He's talking about what else can we do up there. We're going to try to run a really great pediatric hospital, of course, but what else can we do that makes us more relevant and useful to the neighborhood around that? So I think it's very much in the culture of this university now. I think a large part because of President Fry's efforts, everybody's thinking about, well, what else can we do? We don't control all the things. We don't control the games. We don't control all the real estate. You know, we have our own limit. Any anchor institution has its own limitations. But I was really pleased. And I said this to a couple of people after our last monthly meeting. I said, I'm really pleased that we even think about this stuff.
Yeah, for it being a private institution, it's pretty amazing that that's even a thought. Before we wrap up, I want to go back to this one point, something that we talked about before we even started to record today.
Yeah.
That's the concept of Philadelphia as a village. Can you just tell me a little bit more about your thoughts of Philadelphia as a village?
Well, my latest little quote is the Village of Philadelphia.
The Village of Philadelphia.
This is the biggest city in America that I think acts like a village. It is, you know, first of all, it is physically, it is tighter than most cities because of its colonial past and its colonial streetscape. And, you know, Walnut Street in Center City is a major shopping street, and the curb to curb dimension is 27 feet. That's nothing.
Yeah.
But it creates a kind of spatial reality, which interests me, obviously, as an architect and a planner. It creates a spatial reality, which is really wonderful. And it is very European-like. Europeans come here and they don't necessarily get the culture part immediately, but they get the spatial part. And in fact, years ago, there was a series of advertisements that were running in France for Philadelphia, and I won't butcher the French language by saying it in French, but the English translation was Philadelphia, the American exception. Meaning
that's interesting.
Meaning that the Europeans, at least French, understood that Philadelphia had a relationship to European scale and kind of community building through space that was not unlike something they have. And I think that's an enormous asset for us. And I think before we were recording, we were talking about, you know, I used to be able to walk out of my office when I was with the city at 16th and Arch. I could walk out. I could just plant myself in Love Park if I wanted. And I could do 4 and 5 different business things just because of people walking around and coming by. It's like, oh, I owe you an email or I owe you a phone call. Why don't we just figure it out right now? This used to happen all the time. And I think it happens out here in University City.
It definitely does. I can't walk up down the block without running into a couple people.
Yeah. And I think it's how people build a shared community and a shared experience in the city that makes the city more vibrant. That's what cities do when they do it well. And it part of that being able to do it well in this city is about the scale of the city and the fact that if you and I know each other and we're walking on opposite sides of the street, if those streets are only 27 feet across, we're going to figure out a way to communicate. If those streets are 100 feet across, as it is in many American cities with multi-laned avenues and so on, we might wave to each other at best, but we keep moving.
Thanks so much for listening, and a very special thank you to Alan Greenberger for taking the time to visit with us for a conversation. If you have any further thoughts on this discussion or would like to recommend a future interview, Send us a message on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or an email to info@parallaxcollab.com. We'd love to hear from you. And of course, a very special thank you to Christopher Heckler for editing today's episode, Helene Furan and Lee Nentwig, who also helped produce this interview, and Kiliman Zigo creates our music. This podcast is made possible with support from Drexel University's Excite Center, Design Futures Lab, and a recording space at the Dornsife Center for Community Partnerships. Until next time.